You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connections of Dots.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on Bright Wednesday, because every day this week is a day of Bright Week. So it's Bright Wednesday today, which is a much better Wednesday than Spy Wednesday, which was last week. And we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett is, of course, the world-famous author, raconteur, Dutch uncle.
Troublemaker.
Troublemaker, southern gentleman, speaking to us from the Smoky Mountains in Tennessee. Or is it Tennessee or Tennessee?
Well, it depends on... depends. Actually, I live very close to the village from which the whole state gets its name. And it is usually spelled T-A-N-A-S-I, Tennessee, the
Tennessee.
Cherokee village where the whole state got started. And so you could say it that way. You could say Tennessee.
I had literally no idea. You know, you guys back east have, well, except when you get up into Massachusetts and stuff, the Indian place names are much easier to say than they are out here in Washington. Washington has like really weird Indian places.
Oh, we might throw you a curve or two down here in Cherokee country, but yes, you do have some strange ones up there.
We got great ones up here. You know, Snoqualmie, Snoqualmie.
Right.
A lot.
Well, you've been to New Zealand.
Yeah.
Town names in New Zealand are impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, they're even worse. The Maori names are really tough.
Yeah.
You know, including like Maori is not spelled like it's pronounced. And we got those here. So like if I just say Puyallup, which is one of our local place names, you could guess for a good long while about how to spell Puyallup, and you would always be wrong. It's not spelled any way like it sounds. So Puyallup is spelled P-U-Y-A-L-L-U-P. That makes no sense. You know, we are the people who gave you this gigantic clam, which is also called by a local Indian name. It's called the gooey duck. So you would
I've heard of this, yeah.
Yeah, so you would assume, you know, something like G-O-O-E-Y, gooey, you know?
Right.
You could even buy that, okay, clams are kind of gooey. So, you know, okay, gooey duck, who knows why it's called a gooey duck. But it turns out that it's spelled G-E-O-D-U-C-K, geoduck. That makes no sense. So there's a lot of that.
Life, as they say, is full of surprises.
Yes, yes. Perhaps during the break, I will go and find. There's a terrific poem that was written by a local here, a guy named Willard Espy, who wrote a book called Words at Play, which is oodles of fun. And he was from a little town called Oysterville, out on the shores of Puget Sound, across the water from where I live. And he wrote an entire poem that was just made of Washington place names. And it's just a brilliant piece of work.
Sounds great.
But but it manages to incorporate, you know, local names like Klickitat. And I think he even manages to get Hump Tulips in there. That's a real place. Hump Tulips.
Don't doubt it.
It is a real place. So, yeah, we have.
I think probably the king is probably Wales. Welsh place names probably take the cake.
Yeah, with no vowels in them. Or with no vowels in them. Just these There lurked like Serbian name. Years ago, there was an Onion article about how the Clinton administration was airlifting critically needed vowels to Serbian villages.
Speaking of no vowels, how many of our listeners realize that the Hebrew Bible is like that? Most of our Bible manuscripts and old Bibles from Old Testament Hebrew Bibles don't have vowels, they're all consonants, but there's not any gaps between the words either.
Yeah.
You just have to be smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. This is where rabbinic tradition
comes in. Something else, isn't it?
Yep. Well, you know, Greek manuscripts are like that too, because paper was, you know, you just didn't like run off to Office Depot and go pick up a sheaf of 500 pieces of paper. So you may do if you had old. This is one of the reasons that a lot of ancient books disappeared, is because you just took the old paper and you just, or vellum, for example, you just scrubbed it clean of whatever had been written on there, because who cares about that? And then you would write over it.
Right.
And so lots of ancient books got destroyed that way.
Controversy over supposed. I haven't heard an update on that. Have you heard an update on the supposed first century Gospel of Mark that got turned into a mummy mask?
You know, I heard about that years ago.
No, it's not that far back. It's maybe 2 years ago.
Okay, yeah. I remember hearing about this. It was some speculation.
Well, it may be the original discovery was a while back, but it was recently sold. This mummy mask is made of paper mache. Not all of them were made of gold like King Tut's.
Right.
And the paper had been made, or some version of paper mache, papyrus mache, maybe.
Okay.
And it had previously been apparently a copy of the Gospel of Mark, but maybe the oldest one in existence.
That would be so, super cool if they were able to tease that thing apart.
Indeed. And there was controversy over it because atheists and secularists said that that a priceless piece of Egyptology had been destroyed for Christian apologetic purposes, which is a really foolish thing to say, it turns out. Apparently these mummies, paper mummy masks, are a dime a dozen. There's a great many of them. And they're, you know, they're valuable in the sense of a curiosity and stuff, but usually not very interesting, whereas a first century Gospel of Mark would be literally priceless.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
I think the man who sold the mummy mask made a good deal.
That's amazing. You know,
with today's new techniques, they're thinking they might be able to get at the text. So it won't be the complete gospel, of course, but it may be a substantial chunk. So
it makes you wonder, you know, where they got it. It's interesting that Mark would turn up in Egypt. It's probably was initially, of course, written to the Roman Church. One of the interesting tidbits about the Gospel of Mark is that the Gospel of Mark is the only gospel that bothers to mention the completely unimportant to anybody but members of the Roman Church fact that Simon of Cyrene had a couple of kids named Alexander and Rufus. He just kind of throws this in, right? that they grabbed a guy named Simon of Cyrene and made him carry the cross of Jesus. And then Mark tosses in this parenthetical remark that he's the father of Alexander and Rufus. And it's like, why does Mark do that? Well, the reason Mark does that is because the Roman Church knows Alexander and Rufus. They're members of the Roman Church.
That's pretty good, yeah.
And so it's just kind of a shout out to these guys who were members of the congregation. Which does a number of things. One of the things that it does is it makes very real all of a sudden that the participants in the gospel story that we're reading about in the Gospel of Mark are not people for the Roman church that's first reading this gospel. These are not people who lived long ago and far away. These are
the next generation.
Yeah, I was watching this documentary yesterday. It was an interview with a guy named James Carrico, Dr. James Carrico. And it was the recording was made.
Right in thinking that's the doctor who tried to save JFK's life?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
He was in the trauma room on November 22nd, 1963. When the call came in, and so they didn't know what was going on, so they went to the trauma room, and they brought in – the first guy they brought in was Governor Connally. It was they had to get him out of the car so they could get to JFK. And so he was just telling this story about, the people who were there and et cetera. And this is a recording that was made in 1997, so about 30 years after the events. So about the distance in time, in fact, that between Mark – and the events that he's talking about. And what was interesting was the guy, as he's kind of telling this story, he would mention, so-and-so was there, putting in the saline and O-positive blood and so on and so forth. And he just kind of would casually mention that, yeah, that guy, he was like an intern at that time, but now he works, across town over at the blood bank. And a lot of the people that were there that day were like still around, living in Dallas, and he just kind of references them casually. And it's like that when you're reading the Gospel of Mark, because you're listening to the testimony of somebody for whom a lot of the witnesses are still around. Everybody knows them.
Pretty good.
So it's interesting. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Rod Bennett, and we'll be back talking about Easter and mummies and the Gospel of Mark right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. One of the interesting things, speaking of manuscripts and stuff, one of the things that you'll often hear is that the church suppressed the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels were, if the church hadn't destroyed them all, we would be in possession of this treasure trove of alternative knowledge about Jesus and so on and so forth. Well, in fact, thereby hangs a tale, because in fact, everything that we know about the Gnostic Gospels was known to us for centuries because fathers of the church, most notably Irenaeus, carefully preserved tons of knowledge about Gnostics. He wrote an entire book called Adversus Heresies, Against the Heresies.
Five books, actually.
Yeah. In which, among other things, he very carefully reproduced what the Gnostics said, typically in their own words.
He goes out of his way to say repeatedly, I'm not making this stuff up, as crazy as it sounds.
It really is.
I'm recording an accurate depiction of what these guys really do believe in.
Right, and one of the arguments before the discovery of Nag Hammadi — Nag Hammadi is a library in Egypt that happened to be located in a place, namely not the Nile Delta, where the air is really dry. A lot of us always, when we think of Egypt, we always think of Cairo and sand and the pyramids and desert and that kind of stuff. But that's not all of Egypt. And the closer you get to the Nile Delta, the closer you get to a lot of moisture in the air and dampness and consequently destruction of manuscripts due to mold and all this kind of stuff. But in 1945, the Nag Hammadi Library was discovered. And the Nag Hammadi Library had a ton of, among other things, Gnostic manuscripts, including things that had been lost for 2,000 years. And so this treasure trove of Gnostic manuscripts was discovered, and lo and behold, it turned out that Irenaeus had been just fastidiously accurate.
If anything, he's a little too charitable.
Yeah.
The rap on him up to that point was, well, you know, this is obviously a biased Christian account. You know, they're right. You know, this is them trying to make these guys look foolish, you know.
Right, right. Because Gnostic manuscripts say really weird things. And that's one of the things that he kept, you know, remarking on was, you know, this stuff is silly.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The question then becomes, well, okay, first of all, the church didn't destroy Gnostic manuscripts. You know why? Because the church had no power. At the time, Gnosticism was at its height. It was the second century.
Yeah, early to mid second century
is really the high water mark for Gnosticism, and the church is not a state church at this point. It has no power to do anything about anything, you know, that it doesn't like. Later on, there would be moments at which, you know, books are burned and so forth by the state. That does happen later on. But nothing happened at the hands of Christians to Gnostic manuscripts. So what happened? Well, I used to work at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, we had like the little rest area that had like, you know, people do this sometimes. People would like bring in their crappy Danielle Steele novels and whatever other books that they had that they didn't want, and they'd stick them on the shelf there for others to read while they're taking a break if they wanted to do that. It was a way to get rid of their crummy novels that they didn't want that somebody had given them for Christmas. And one of the books that they had on the shelf was this book. I never forgot it. It was Better Living Through Willpower. And it was some book that was published in like 1953 by some guy you've never heard of, with his theory about how if you grit your teeth and clench your bum really hard, then you can achieve whatever it is that you want to do through willpower. And that was his big theory, was better living through willpower. And so there this book sat on the shelf all alone, with nobody to read it, because no one cared about better living through willpower. And you know, and the book was long out of print, and no one had ever heard of it, and I'd never heard of it until I found it on the shelf. And so the question is, who suppressed better living through willpower?
We did.
Well, no one suppressed Better Living Through Willpower. People just didn't read it, right? And so
the world collectively suppressed it by responding to it with a giant yawn.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what happened to the Gnostic Gospels. Nobody suppressed the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels just went away because people stopped reading them. And, you know, back in the day, when the only way you got more copies of a book was to hand copy the entire book, you got really choosy about which books you wanted to copy, because that's a lot of work.
Right.
Hand copying, you know, the Gospel of Judas Iscariot or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. It's just a lot of effort, and nobody's reading this thing. So they just stopped copying them. And that's what happened to the Gnostic Gospels. There is no big conspiracy. It was just, yeah, this is junk, and I'm not interested in reading it, and I'm sure not interested in copying it. Right. So I'm not going to do that anymore. So these books got thrown into some clay pots somewhere in Egypt at the Nag Hammadi Library, and there they sat.
And they outlived the weird little splinter groups that had generated them by centuries.
Right. So they just sat there gathering dust in these pots, and nobody cared about them. And that's it. That's the explanation for the Gnostic Gospels. There was no grand conspiracy. And we would totally have forgotten about them altogether had not large portions of them been lovingly preserved in the writings of Irenaeus, which
did get... Chesterton who said that the church has this common failing of taking the heresy more seriously than the heretics do. And so we've lovingly cherished Irenaeus for nearly 2,000 years now. And
yeah.
And he's got all of these records of books that where he carefully takes apart extinct heresies that nobody cares about anymore and didn't care about for very long even then. And so they've sort of been, the heresy's been enshrined in the annals of the Catholic Church. So that's pretty interesting.
Well, and
something similar happens to the Arian heresy a little later.
Yeah, exactly.
The charge is made that the Church, which really did have the power to suppress by the time of Constantine. Mm-hmm. In fact, Constantine orders the books of Arius to be burned at the end of the council, the Nicene Council in 325.
Yeah.
But the problem is the refutation of Arius's books occupies the world's time for the next 150 years. So that practically every word he ever wrote is enshrined in some passage from the Church Fathers.
This goes to something that's a very common argument. You find variations of it. You know, the argument put forward that history books are written by the winners is one of the things that you often hear. The problem with that argument is, you know what? It turns out that we actually know, for example, quite a bit about the Confederacy.
Right.
It turns out that the writings of the Confederacy, or, you know, we know a great deal about King George III. We know ever so much about the Nazis.
Also, history doesn't cooperate with this idea very much. Okay, I've just confessed that Constantine ordered the Arian writings burned at the end of the Nicene Council. The usual rap on him is, well, see, this shows that Constantine is the one who created Catholic orthodoxy. He sponsored the particular version of Christianity that he favored most, and he suppressed the rest of them. And that's why the Catholic Church rose to the fore, because it had the sponsorship of the emperor. Well, it sounds great. It's a neat little theory. The trouble is, the more you learn about the story, the less cooperative the story is. it turns out that like a year and a half later, after Constantine had declared Arius the agent of the devil and ordered his books burnt and all the rest of it, within a year and a half of the close of the council, Constantine changes his mind, rehabilitates Arius completely, and allows all of his books to be republished. How many people remember that part of the story?
And it was in fact,
and as a matter of fact, Constantine waffles on this issue for the rest of his life.
Right.
So, and when he comes to his deathbed, he's finally baptized by the head of the Arian movement.
Wow.
So
yeah.
It messes the story up, you know.
Right. And in fact, well,
it seems a shame, doesn't it?
I will tell you about an article idea I've had kicking around in my mind, which I may yet write when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we are talking about, well, golly, mummies and Arius and Constantine. Oh my! And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Redbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. And we were talking about the Arian heresy. The really shallow, I think, take on history that it lies at the back of the old lie that history is written by the winners. It's just not true. It's not true that when you lose a particular historical argument or a war, that all knowledge of the losers just vanishes. It's just not true. You know, the South lost the Civil War, and we know everything there is to know about the South and the Civil War. And we know everything there is to know about Nazi Germany. We know everything there is to know about Imperial Japan after World War II and so on and so forth. It's just not the case. And it's not the case in the history of the church. There's a famous little book in some circles called The Trail of Blood. And it's very popular with a kind of certain species of Baptist.
Yeah.
And the argument goes that after the last apostles died, then the whole church, the entire church, completely went off the rails suddenly.
Right. Another great apostasy theory.
Right. And the great apostasy happened, and somehow or other, the Catholic Church took over and proceeded to just stamp out the memory of true apostolic Christianity. But, of course, didn't get rid of the Bible and the New Testament or anything, which would be kind of key if that's really the goal, right, is to just eradicate the memory of true Christianity and just replace it with Catholicism. You'd think that burning the New Testament would be a real priority. But no. Instead, they lovingly preserved the New Testament, but for 15 centuries, true Christianity was just completely driven underground, and every time it reared its head, the Catholic Church just stamped it out. And so every heresy, quote-unquote, that arose between the New Testament period and the Protestant Reformation, these were all incipient Protestants who were trying to bring back the true Christian tradition, but the Catholic Church just stomped them all out ruthlessly.
Yeah, the church has been playing whack-a-mole for the past 2,000 years. And
finally lost at the Reformation, and then true Christianity emerged back into the daylight and so on and so forth. Well, here's the thing. I mean, it's just not the case that these heresies that Catholics attacked, were incipient Protestantism. In the
particular case of the Baptists, it's really odd. I used to be a Baptist, so I know whereof I speak.
Okay.
When they went looking for primitive progenitors, you know, when they went looking for true Christians, that is, Baptists, hiding throughout history underground, mm-hmm. Anything with the word Baptist in it would work.
Okay.
In other words, they since the Baptist church, one of the Baptist church's special pride and joys is the idea that we don't baptize infants. They emphasize that, you know.
Right.
You might think that a church with the name Baptist puts a special emphasis on baptism, but in reality, they don't assign a great deal of significance to baptism. But they do want, if you are going to baptize, which you should, you got to do it right. That's when it really becomes important, not this infant baptism stuff. So they'll go through history and look for any group that almost any group that had the word Baptist in the name. But one of they'll, like, for example, they'll go to the Anabaptists, a very chaotic, strange movie, a movement. The Anabaptists were a very strange movement with which the Baptist Church would have nothing to do if they ran into it today. But because one of their grab bag of new ideas was only to baptize adults, then they were picked as an example of heroic proto-Baptists that were crushed.
Right.
And so you run interestingly, these... they were mainly crushed by Lutherans rather than Catholics.
Anabaptists got it in another story. Everybody. Yeah, I feel bad for Anabaptists because they were pretty brutally treated by everybody. But you know, when you look at, you know, Arianism, for example, the whole point of Arianism was, at the end of the day, was to deny the deity of Jesus.
I'd push it back a step further. I would say they tried to save strict numerical oneness in God. It's a reaction to the doctrine of the Trinity.
Right.
To say that they denied the divinity of Jesus makes it sound as if they were humanitarians in a later sense.
Right.
In other words, that they wanted to Jesus was a prophet or a, you know, Eastern sage or something, and they were very far from that. Jesus any honor that they could. They fell overboard with honorifics for Jesus. His preexistence before creation, his omnipotent power, his omniscience, his all of it. They would grant him everything, every single attribute of divinity except co-equalness with God.
Right.
In other words, to have existed, to be equally eternal with the Father, to have existed from all eternity was the one single thing that they wouldn't concede to him. Right. And their motivation for doing that was, if he existed from all eternity, then there were two gods.
Right.
So the whole motivation for the thing was to attack the doctrine of the Trinity. By coming up with some way in which God, Jesus, is equally God in just about every way, except that there was, in their famous phrase, a time when the Son was not.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, I pointed this out in the past, back when the Da Vinci Code was like a big thing, is that, you know, if Dan Brown had walked into the Council of Nicaea, you know, with his theory that Jesus was just a dead rabbi with a girlfriend, he would not have gotten as far as the Catholic bench of bishops, because the Arian bishops would have
rent their garments and anathematized him long before he got to the Catholics. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. The idea that everybody at the Council of Nicaea agrees that Jesus is an immensely powerful supernatural being.
Yeah.
That's not even
creator of the world.
Right. Yeah. It's not
they
even
they all
issue.
Agreed on that.
Yeah. It's a remarkably arcane point that they're arguing about for moderns. And the idea that he was just this guy, you know, with some theory about the sacred feminine or something like that.
Right. Right. Well, they couldn't resist pegging Constantine for the great apostasy. It's such an easy mark, you know.
Right.
There's no question that something enormous happened when the church, you know, emerged into official sponsorship from the Roman government. That's no doubt a watershed in history.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's a natural thing to sort of peg your apostasy to, even though it's not really good for that purpose.
This doesn't work. You know, this reminds me. I thought about writing an article one time. I may do it one of these days. It was funnier about 10 years ago, just because the time period was the same. But I thought about writing an article about how, you know, it's been 40 years since the council, and the church has just gone to hell. And, you know, this council should never have happened, and it was a big disaster. And now look, you know, all the laxness and you know, our leaders are all abandoning the faith and an apostate. And then I it was going to be like this editorial, you know, to the paper complaining about how everything sucks because of the council. And then I was going to date it 363 AD. Because that's exactly what was going on, you know, 40 years after the Council of Nicaea.
Right. I think almost every council must get some version of this.
Yeah.
It absolutely was the claim of Arius and the and his followers that that the council, for example, had used terms that don't appear in Scripture.
Right. Which is true.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
They, in other words, the Arians claim to be the traditionalists.
Yeah.
We're saying something that that people like us have said for a long time, and all of a sudden you're stamping us out, and you're introducing innovations.
Yep.
And so I think this must be a common. One of the things I don't think that's given enough. Enough thought to either, although maybe it is, and I haven't read the books, but and that is the way in which the councils, at the end of every council, both sides go home and claim victory, whether they got it or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Arius could point to Jesus saying, the Father is greater than I. He could point to Jesus.
This day I have begotten thee, you know. There's all sorts of scriptural fodder.
You could point to Jesus saying, why do you call me good? There is none good but God.
Right, all of it.
And say, you know, look, I'm just following the Bible here. That was, you know, which is, of course, what every heretic has always said.
Right.
That was exactly the argument that was put forward. And it was what it depended on, as what it always depends on, of course, was not merely the Bible alone. It depended on the Bible as it had always been understood by the church. And, you know, on that point, the Catholics completely swept the field, you know, because they were just right. The church had always honored Jesus as in the way that the council spoke of him, God from God, light from light, true God from true God. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media talking about the Council of Nicaea and other exciting things right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett. If you want to give us a call, you know, if you feel like you need to weigh in on the Council of Nicaea, thumbs up, thumbs down, you know, or maybe it's too early to tell. Who knows?
The jury's still out.
But if you want to talk about any of that, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and you can join the station. Yeah. The whole notion that we can't know anything about, you know, the heresies that the church opposed because it's all being filtered down to us through biased sources and et cetera, is, I think, is just rubbish. we know a lot about these heresies, and exactly because of the point that you made, you know, the Chesterton made, that the church did the heresies the favor of taking them more seriously often than the heretics did.
Than they had they deserved.
Yeah. You know, well, Thomas Aquinas is great for this. When you read Thomas, Thomas deals in his Summa Theologiae with about, I think, like 10,000 questions, objections to the faith about you name it. you know, just beginning. He doesn't even begin. He's so thorough that he doesn't even begin with the question of, is there a God? That's not where he starts.
What, when you're reading him, what you feel like he's missing all the way through is, doesn't he realize that the people who raise this stuff don't really mean it? In other words, they just found something that sounded like a stick that was good enough to beat the church with.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it was a slogan, you know. And that is the truth most of the time. Many of these folks will come up with some, you know, stumper, they think, you know. Can God create a rock too heavy for him to lift and things like that? And they'll throw it out and say, hey, there you go, you Catholics. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And the church sees it and goes, wow, you know, that is a really interesting point that you raise. And then the church begins methodically examining it carefully, going over it, comparing it to the ancient fathers and doctors and all the rest of it. And meanwhile, the heretic is going,
I didn't really care that much.
I mean, you can continue as long as you want here, but that wasn't really my point. Yeah. My point was, I'm mad at you guys, and I wanted to say something to hit back. And meanwhile, Thomas has written, you know, 300 pages on your stick.
On your flippant thing that you threw at the church. but that's the way Thomas is, you know.
Right.
And he will consistently, nobody gives a fairer shake to the objections to the church than Thomas. He will
always says it better than they do. They can.
Yeah. He will always state the objections as clearly as he possibly can and give them as much, you know, ammo as possible to make a really good objection. One of the things that's always struck me is because realizing that he is so thorough in stating the objections to the faith, and he's so fair, is that when you get to the most basic objection to the faith that there can be, namely, is there a God? yes or no. What's really striking is that in the whole history of human thought, Thomas can only find two really decent objections to the existence of God. That's it. That's all there is. Just two good objections. He can't find any other ones. And the two
now,
objections.
Admittedly, one of them is a doozy.
Sure. It's the best objection there is. One of them is, of course, the reality of evil. If God is, you know, the classic statement is, if God is all good and all powerful, then evil shouldn't exist.
Whereas if he is all powerful and we have evil anyway, then he must want it here. It must be your own purpose.
Or he's not really all powerful. Maybe he doesn't
one
like evil,
two.
But can't do anything about it. And either of those is fatal to the existence of God. So what do you do? And so that's the first and biggest objection. And you can hear a million different variations on that objection. So, you know, if God, then why the Holocaust? If God, then why did my son die? If God, then, you know, name any bad thing. 9/11, you know.
And one of the very best things about the Catholic faith is the Catholic faith gives you a moment or two to hear them say, you know, you're right. That is a really, really good point.
Right.
And almost nobody else does that.
Right.
And so, almost everybody else immediately tries to shut you up with the answer.
Right. And the only other objection is basically boils down to everything seems to be working fine without God. So there's no God. And this is what a lot of objections to the existence of God rooted in, for example, evolutionary theory.
Right. That he's not necessary. We figured out how to make it work without him.
Right. We figured out, you know, so we used to think that lightning was the wrath of God, but now we know that lightning is electricity, therefore there's no God. We used to think that animals were especially created by God, you know, on the fifth day, but now we understand how evolution works, and so no God. And those are both variations on that, that everything works fine without God, so there's no God. You can also work in the problem of evil with evolution if you like, too, because evolution, among other things, involves a lot of animals killing each other and a lot of, well, living things killing each other.
You know what's the really fatal flaw for evolution to, against evolutionism?
Okay.
Evolutionism requires chance and randomness, and there isn't any such thing.
Okay. It also requires, as was famously put, you know, give me, you know, the conditions of planet Earth 3.5 billion years ago in sufficient time, and I will give you, you know, the diversity of life that we see now. And the response of the Christian, the Judeo-Christian theist to that all, of course, is get your own planet. Yeah, and your own 3.5 billion years, and you know that's what this comes back to. Of course, is what Thomas does when he's arguing for the existence of God is he never tries to argue from miracles or things we can't explain. He's not interested in that at all. He doesn't say, well, you know, if God, then explain smallpox. Because he knows that it's perfectly possible that there is a natural explanation for smallpox. And we'll find it one of these days.
This is really what I meant by saying there's no such thing as chance or randomness. I don't mean that in a spiritual or Christian sense. I just mean if you tell a computer to generate a random number, it will look at you and go, what?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? What do you mean? Explain this thing random. I don't know random.
Yeah.
Computers don't know random. They have to be programmed to simulate random. In other words, a throw of the dice is not random or chance. It's just extremely complex. It's complex enough that it passes for chance.
Right.
Okay? Turns out the whole universe is like that.
Chance very often means just, you know, I don't understand it, so I'm going to call it chance.
There's no such thing as chance. Everything is exactly where it should be based on where things were a micro millisecond ago. And the millisecond before that. Everything's following its path, its predictable course, you know, all the way back to the original singularity. So everything's perfectly plottable. So you can't tell the computer, give me chance, because there's no chance. Everything is just where you would predict it to be if you were smart enough. Well, and God is smart enough.
And the what Thomas does when he's arguing for creation is he doesn't say there are things I don't understand, therefore God. What he does is he asks a perfectly reasonable question, why is there anything? What evolution always has to presuppose, of course, is that there is something.
Right.
Something acted on something, and the result of those interactions is what we call evolution. And Thomas has no problem with that. He has no problem with the idea that the universe has invested in it powers that unroll. The Latin for that is evolvere. And that's where we get the word evolution from. So Thomas would look at something like evolution and see in it a minor evidence for the existence of God. But anyway, well, we're out of time, sadly, but we'll be back tomorrow. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We were here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We'll be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about life at the movies. Until then, have a glorious evening and a happy, bright Wednesday. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.